and a jutting, dimpled ass, perfectly round. While the pastor was covered in invisible white hairs that tickled anyone he sat by, Greg was a smooth slab of corn-fed farm boy. "They're not related at all," Pally decided.
"Oh, flex that ass," muttered the pastor, watching his assistant.
"This reminds me of Fiji," said Pally.
"Why Fiji?" asked the pastor.
"I used to go swimming with the Catholic seminarians there. This was before I decided to study the teachings of Martin Luther," said Pally.
"Where do you swim?" asked the pastor.
"At the waterfall near Suva.
Once, a Tongan woman from New Zealand joined us. She said she was a writer. We could see her breasts under her wet lava-lava, and she said all sorts of suggestive things."
"Like what?" asked the pastor.
"I made hors d'oeuvres," said Greg, jumping up and running out of the sauna.
"My son is nervous today," said the pastor. "You'd think it was the first time we've had a guest from overseas."
The snow was ripping through the air outside. Pally stood in the master bedroom wearing a lava-lava that the pastor had given him.
"I've bought one for each of us. They're Polynesian pareos," said the pastor.
"It looks Malaysian," Pally said, noting the paisley patterns.
"So it's true they don't wear anything underneath?" said the pastor, rubbing his eyebrow, looking down at his tint.
"Suits the climate," said Pally. "I can't seem to find any of my clothes right now."
"Probably in the laundry," said the pastor. "We always try to get the visitor's effects immediately into the wash."
"Seminarians."
The pastor tried pressing his hard-on against Pally's hip bone. Pally felt only Abba, Fa'alo'alo, and Olofa Mo Le To'aina. Respect, reverence, and love for one's elder. He found the Minnesota Lutheran clergyman's home life exotic. He went down the stairs and into the carpeted living room. The pastor, chasing after him, tucked the hem of his pareo into the waistband, his now shrinking but still swollen member tossing up and about.
"Pally, Pally, I just want to chat," shouted the pastor, as Pally dodged the oak furniture and scattered Pastor Narfson's extensive collection of wooden craft items. Knocking over an elmwood rabbit, Pally raced through the kitchen and out into the sun deck.
The snow was now flying about in big wet flakes, hitting Polly's black hair and smooth back. Like footballers in training, Pally and the pastor ran high-stepping around the house through the deep, icy prairie grass. Pally came around to the front door and went in, slamming it behind him, locking it, and drawing the chain. The pastor shook the doorknob angrily. After all, it was his home. He got the key from under the planter and unlocked the door, but the chain stopped him.
"Oh, gall darn, you went and did it," he shouted.
Pally watched garden clippers snip through the imitation brass door chain, then walked back up the stairs to another bedroom, closing the latch on the bedroom doorknob. He was in his guest room. Greg lay on his bed with his face in the pillow. His legs spread in a V-shape toward Pally. Greg turned around and asked, "Would you like to smoke?"
"I bet the pastor decides to watch TV. He's like that. Exists from one moment to the next."
It was quiet in the house. Pally could hear a Vikings football pre-game talk show on the TV from the living room. He sat on the bed next to Greg.
"I made sushi for you," said Greg.
"Huh?" said Pally, taking some rolls from the hors d'oeuvre plate.
"Well, it's really California roll, made with lefse."
"It's good,"
said Pally, eating another palmful. Greg lit a joint and pulled a box of poppers and lube from the drawer.
We probably seem pushy to you, asked Greg before holding his breath and then blowing smoke into Pally's lungs. It's my dang dad. He acts like a kid sometimes.
The chasing reminds me of kids, said Pally.
Greg put aside the smoke and pushed Pally down, their tongues entangling like crazed flags. In reply, Pally pulled Greg onto himself. He ran his palms down Greg's curved back into his pareo, caressing his ass cheeks. Greg swiveled and ground his chest into Pally's. Pally pinched Greg's nipples between his thumbs and forefingers. From beneath, Pally humped Greg's groin with his own. And through their pareos, their cocks tracked and slipped. Greg's tongue beat against Pally's lips, nostrils, bridge, eyelids, into his ear, along his shoulder, into his armpit, inside his elbow, into his pareo, and finally, led by the veins, brought Pally's dick into his mouth and slicked the cock with his spit. Pally balanced on his elbow in the bed and turned Greg's body around as they each pulled the pareo from the other's body, and each fucked their cocks into the other's mouth. Pally slid on top and, arching from the root, sent the tip of his prick beyond Greg's throat muscle, forcing him to control his breath. Greg hummed into the head of Pally's dick. They turned and turned back on the bed again and again, without releasing each other. The Vikings game played out downstairs, and the pastor tossed in his chair, thinking of yet another guest one-on-one with Greg. Greg pushed Pally back on the bed, his knees on either side of Pally's waist. He pressed his asshole onto Pally's standing dick and took it slowly in. Greg's cock branched hard into Pally's sliding fist. Each inner ring of his ass opened until Pally's cock was buried deep inside. Pally's stroking blurred. Greg's cum shot into the wall beside the bed and ran down Pally's wrist. Pally took Greg's legs in his arms and brought Greg belly down onto the bed, arching his hips into Greg's clutching cheeks. Pally's face was empty like a runner's. Greg's groans carried into the living room. Pally came inside Greg's smooth, shaking ass. Then he kissed Greg's thick shoulders, pressed his face against Greg's, and closed his eyes. Our wives will be coming back from their shopping trip to Chicago tonight. It's only been a weekend, but I miss the grandchildren, said the pastor at breakfast the next morning. Pally watched Greg, who was working the Sunday crossword puzzle. Before you could say kafefi, Pally was back on the freeway headed toward the towers of the Twin Cities. This time the pastor himself drove him. Greg stayed home, trying to repair a bicycle for one of his young daughters.
You know, it's about time Greg took his own parish, said the pastor in the car. I'm thinking of a really nice place I know near Moscow, Minnesota.
Pally was entertaining thoughts of becoming a Buddhist. He met some Tibetan monks at a doll store in Stillwater. Minnesota has the largest Tibetan population in the U.S., they told him.
Oh, what a shame I will bring to my family if I return to Samoa without a degree in Lutheran divinity, thought Pally to himself.
Better to hide myself in this place forever. Become a prostitute or a computer programmer. What other work had the seminary trained him for?
Pastor Narfson noted Pally's distraction and suggested they stop outside Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport to watch the jets take off. They sat silently together in the pastor's car, parked within the repair yard fence. The planes taxied one at a time up to a turning mark near their viewpoint. Rumbling, the aircraft raced onto the field. Watching,
Polly decided he would finish out the years of study he had begun. Marry a nice Samoan Lutheran. Build himself a Swedish sauna near Apia. He leaned back to watch the planes through the sunroof. One by one, he felt them shudder into the air and vanish.
Queer Punk by Bob Vickery from Best American Erotica 1997. Read by Richard Brewer.
I'm still half asleep, staring up at the ceiling and wondering whether or not I should get up. Part of me just wants to roll over and catch a few more Z's, but I don't think my body can take the lumps in the couch anymore. Darlene told me she had found the couch in front of some apartment building a couple of blocks away during a trash pickup day. I can hear Darlene and her dickhead boyfriend Buck in the bedroom. Sounds like they're having a fight. I guess that's better than the times I have to listen to them fuck. Hearing Buck groan like he's got a bad case of the trots. I can't make out most of what they're saying, but every now and then I hear my name. Old Buck is probably ragging on Darlene again about how much longer her deadbeat little brother is going to be hanging around. If it weren't for me, I don't think they'd have anything to talk about. The bedroom door opens, and Buck walks in, wearing nothing but his jockeys. He glances at me once, giving me the evil eye as he makes his way to the kitchen. I give him my best fuck you too look. A few seconds later, he's back with a carton of orange juice in his hand. He takes a swig from it. So, Jamie, he says, how's the job hunt going? I shrug. No luck yet, Buck, I say. I catch myself checking out his body again. It really pisses me off when I do that. Buck works out regularly with his weight set, and his body is tight and cut, but he's such an asshole. I'd cut off my dick before I had anything to do with him. Still, I can't help copping a look at him every now and then. Buck takes another gulp of orange juice. You know, they're looking for a busboy over at that Italian restaurant on Haight. I turn my head and stare at the ceiling again. Thanks. I'll check it out. When monkeys fly out my ass, I think. I can feel Buck's eyes on me. Another thing, Jamie, he says. I don't want you using my weight set anymore. You never put the weights back right. I ignore him, and he goes back into the bedroom. A little later, he comes back out again, dressed for work. He runs a forklift at some Kmart in Daly City. We don't look at each other, and when he leaves, he slams the front door. What a douchebag. A few minutes later, Darlene walks in, wearing a bathrobe. Good morning, Jamie, she says. Hi, I grunt. Darlene scratches her head and yawns. You want some breakfast? I shake my head. Nah, maybe a cup of coffee. Sitting at the kitchen table with her, I can see that Darlene is trying to work herself up to say something. I decide to make it easy for her. I am going to look for work today, Darlene, I say. She looks apologetic. I'm sorry about Buck. I laugh. So am I. I shake a cigarette out of the pack and light it. What do you see in him, Darlene? He's such a loser. Yeah, Darlene snorts. Unlike the parade of winners you've called boyfriends. She bums a cigarette from me and lights it, even though I know she's trying to quit. She breathes out a cloud of smoke. Listen, Jamie, she says. I gotta go to work soon. How about you doing the laundry? Buck's been grousing about running out of clean shirts, and I just don't have time to do it myself today. I make a face, and Darlene's eyes shoot daggers at me. Don't give me a hard time about this, Jamie, she says in a pissed tone of voice. I've already had to deal with Buck's bullshit this morning, and I don't want any attitude from you. I don't say anything. Okay, fine, Darlene snaps. I'll do the goddamn laundry myself when I get home from work today. I push my chair out and get up. Oh, chill out, Darlene. I'll do the fucking laundry. Darlene still looks pissed. I guess I didn't agree nicely enough. She gets up and piles the dishes in the sink. When she leaves, the goodbye she throws over her shoulder at me is like a fucking icicle. As soon as she's gone, I go to the bathroom and work out with Buck's weight set. I check myself out in the mirror as I do my curls. I look fucking good. My biceps pumped up nicely, my pecs hard and defined. I put the dumbbells down and pose, flexing my arms, checking out my definition. Hot stuff. I drop my shorts and stare at my reflection. My dick flops against my thigh, half hard, but under my gaze it stirs and stiffens, the head flaring out. I fucking love my cock. The meatiness of it, its redness and thickness. How the veins snake up the shaft. I wrap my hand around it and begin stroking. First slow and easy, then picking up the tempo till my balls are a bouncing blur. I pull my dick down and let it slap against my belly, and then shake it at my reflection. You wanna suck on it? I crooned at the hot, naked stud looking back at me. You want me to fuck your face? Ram this dick down your throat? A sexy punk with too much attitude stares back, sneering, shaking his dick at me as well. I walk up to the mirror and start humping my reflection, my body pressed tight to the glass, my hands grabbing the corners of the closet door. The mirror feels smooth and cool on my skin as I thrust my cock up and down against it. Doesn't take long before I'm ready to shoot. Groaning, I squirt my load on the mirror and watch it as it drips down over my reflection. I wipe my hand across the splattered jizz and lick my fingers clean. Then I clean off the rest of the load with my jockeys and get dressed. I gather all the dirty laundry and take it to the laundromat just down the block. The place is empty, and as the clothes are washing, I sit out in the front step, soaking up rays, smoking the last cigarette in my pack. I think about my living situation. I gotta line up some kind of gig, get some money so I can get my own place. I've been in San Francisco about 3 weeks now, and it's pretty clear that I've just about milked dry the setup I got going with Darlene. When the laundry's done, I toss it into one of the dryers and walk down to Haight Street for more cigarettes. I pass the winos lined up by the supermarket, the panhandlers, runaways, and dopers on the street corners, and buy some Marlboros at the mom and pop over by the park. On the way back, I check out the neighborhood piercing studio. It would be bitching to get my nose pierced, or an eyebrow. But that shit costs more money than I can afford. I push the idea out of my head. The first thing I see back at the laundromat is the open dryer door. Oh shit, I think. A quick check shows that everything's been cleaned out of the dryer. Not just Darlene's and Buck's stuff, but most of the clothes I own as well. The fucker didn't even leave any of my old ratty underwear behind. Fuck! I shout, kicking the dryer door as hard as I can. It slams against the dryer and bounces open again, and I kick it again, hard enough to put a crack in the window. I storm outside and cross the street without looking. A car screeches to a stop, and the driver gives me a 20-second blast on his horn. I spin around and kick one of his headlights out. The dude gets out of his car, and I just wait with clenched fists. He has second thoughts, calls me an asshole, and dries off. I laugh, but I still feel like ripping somebody's head off. Darlene is the first to come home. Even before I open my mouth, I can see she's had a bad day and is not in the mood for any bullshit. When I tell her what happens, she freaks out. What a goddamn stupid thing to do, Jamie! She shouts at me. I can't believe you just left that stuff by itself for anybody to rip off. She goes on like this for a few more minutes. I smoke a cigarette, slouched in a chair, and pretend like I don't hear her. After a while, she storms off to the bedroom. But when she reaches the doorway, she turns around again and glares at me. When Buck gets home, you can go ahead and tell him what happened, she snarls. You can tell him you lost his favorite shirt, the one he always goes bowling in. She slams the door. Jesus fucking Christ, I think. I'm not about to hang around to hear Buck piss and moan at me. I change into my one last t-shirt, the one that says Queer Punk, and head out to Haight Street. A few guys are jamming on one of the street corners, playing guitars and congas, and I hang loose there for a while, toking up whenever the joint they're circulating comes back to me again. Later, I grab a burrito somewhere and wash it down with a couple of beers, then wander up to Club DV8. To see what's happening. Some group called Hogma is playing tonight. Even out here on the street, their music is loud enough to pop an eardrum. The gate man sits on his stool by the door, cracking his knuckles and staring at the world with his fat biker's face. I wait till a group of people show up, pushing through the door, and I crowd in with them, slipping by without paying. By the time the gate man sees me, I'm already in.
"Hey, you!"
he yells. But I dive into all the bodies crammed together on the dance floor and lose the fucker. The band sucks. But I like the way the noise just sweeps over me, pushing everything else out of my head. I grab a beer at the bar and watch the dance floor checking out the guys. There's some hot meat out there tonight. Bodies pumping to the music, slick with sweat, ripe, smelly, pierced, tattooed. My eye suddenly snags on one of them. Not because of his tight, muscular body, which is hot, but because of the t-shirt he's wearing, with the boogers written across it in black and red. I bought that shirt in a Chicago punk club last year. Any doubt I might have that it's the same shirt goes out the window when I see the grease stain on the back that I got from changing the oil in my car. That's the fucker who ripped me off. It looks like he's dancing by himself. I push through the crowd toward him, sometimes losing him in the crush of squirming bodies, but then catching sight of him again, closer each time. I finally squeeze through right behind him. His shaved head, his muscles, and the ring in his left ear make him look like a punk Mr. Clean. Just then, the band stops playing. I put my hand on his shoulder, and he turns to face me, his eyes narrowed. Along with his ear, he's got a ring through his nose, and another piercing his left eyebrow. I smile at him. "Hey, man," I say. "I like your shirt." Then I slug him as hard as I can. The dude falls against the stage, but then comes back at me like a hound from hell. We start slugging it out on the dance floor. He gets a good one to my right eye, but I connect flat on his nose. Blood streams down over his nose ring and splatters my booger shirt. He tries a headbutt on me, but I jerk away in time and hit him with a body tackle. We're down on the floor now, sometimes me on top, sometimes him. The crowd around us is cheering us on. Then I'm on top again. I pull my fist back to give him a pounding so hard his parents will die. Somebody grabs my arm before I get a chance and yanks me to my feet. It's the gate man.
"Okay, you little shithead," he growls. "You've caused enough trouble for the night."
He pins my arm behind my back and shoves me forward through the crowd. People are hooting and jeering on both sides of us. My upper lip is cut, and I can taste my blood as it flows into my mouth. When we reach the door, the gate man gives me a final hard shove, and I go crashing into a parked car. A couple of seconds later, the other guy goes flying through the door as well. The gate man stands at the door, glowering at us with a face like raw ground chuck.
"If I see you guys here again," he snarls, "I'll rip your fucking heads off."
He points a fat finger at me.
"That goes especially for you, asshole."
He goes back inside the club. I climb to my feet, spit the blood out of my mouth. The other guy has pulled off his, or rather my, t-shirt, and is dabbing his bloody nose with it. His body is lean and muscular. His abs are cut like a six-pack, and his pecs are hard and ripped. Both his nipples are pierced, too. His arms are covered with tattoos. I can't make them out in this light, just a few scattered images. Tits, skulls, knives with blood, that kind of shit. "You want to give me my shirt back?" I growl. He looks at me, and then at the shirt in his hand.
"Oh, is this yours?"
he asks, his eyes wide. He blows his nose into it.
"Here,"
he says, tossing it to me. I let it fall to my feet. We glare at each other. His eyes flick down to my queer punk t-shirt, and then back to my face again.
"You queer?"
he asks.
"Okay," I think. "Here comes the bullshit.
It looks like we really are going to have to take up where we left off in the club." "Yeah," I said, squinting.
"What of it?"
"Nothing," he shrugs.
"Except I'm queer, too."
I didn't see that one coming. "So?" I finally say after a couple of beats. He grins, and for once it's not a fuck you grin.
"So? Do you want to fuck?"
I laugh. "Are you for real?" But I start wondering what he looks like naked. The dude shrugs.
"Hey, it was just a thought."
A few seconds go by.
"We could keep on fighting if you want to do that instead," he adds.
It's like we're on a date trying to figure out what movie to see. I take in the muscles, the tattoos, the piercings. In the streetlight, his body shines with sweat. and I can see the meaty bulge in the crotch of his torn jeans. His lip is puffed up where I hit it, pushing his mouth into a permanent sneer. His dark eyes sneer too, looking hard at me, challenging me. I feel my dick growing hard. I haven't been late since I moved to this city, and I'm getting real tired of fucking my fist. Okay, I say slowly. If I get to choose, then I choose fucking. The dude laughs. All right, he says. He sticks out his hand. I'm Crow. I take his hand and shake it. Jamie, I say. Crow lives in a shotgun apartment on Fell Street, one long hallway with a whole bunch of rooms branching off it. He tells me he shares it with four other guys, but it feels as if half of fucking Hate Street is crammed into this place. A tape deck blasts from one of the rooms in the back, playing something from Smashing Pumpkins, and I hear laughter and loud voices. People wander in and out of the kitchen, mostly guys, but a few chicks too. The place smells of grass, incense, and ripe garbage. It makes Darlene and Buck's apartment look like Graceland. Crow's room is nothing more than a storage closet with a mattress on the floor. There's no other furniture in it. No other furniture could fit in it. But there are piles of clothes stacked all along the walls. I recognize some of my stuff. And damn if I don't see Buck's bowling shirt, a neon blue polyester piece of shit that should be taken out somewhere and burned. Crow sees me staring at the clothes. You can have them back if you want, he says, grinning. I don't say anything. I just pull him to me and pry open his mouth with my tongue. Crow wraps his powerful arms around me and starts grinding his crotch against mine. I can feel the bulge of his dick rub against mine, a slow, circular massage of cocks separated by blue denim. With a sudden jerk, he topples us both onto his mattress. He grabs my wrist and pins my arms down as he continues to dry hump me nice and slow. His tongue pushes into my mouth and down my throat, almost deep enough to taste the burrito I had for dinner. I bury my face in his armpit and lick the sweat from it, breathing in deep the rank smell. Crow's body squirms on top of mine, and he bends his neck so that he can stick his tongue in my ear. I trace my own tongue across his firm pecs to his left nipple. It's huge, sticking out sharp and erect like a little toy soldier, with the ring in it gleaming in the light from the bulb overhead. I place the metal loop between my teeth and tug at it. Crow reaches up to yank the string that turns out the light, but I pull his arm away. I want to see your body, I tell him. Crow's mouth curves up into a slow smile. Okay, man, he says. If you want a show, I'll give you one. He stands up at the foot of the mattress and kicks his boots off. I lie back with my hands behind my head and watch. He unzips his jeans and drops them, revealing a pair of bright red bikini briefs. He looks fucking hotter than hell in them. Nice briefs, I say. You've been hitting some high-class laundromats. Crow just laughs. He slowly, teasingly pulls them down, first showing his pubes, then the base of his dick shaft, thick and promising. He stops there. You want to see more? He asks, eyebrows arched. I don't answer, but just reach over and yank his briefs down. His half-hard dick swings heavily between his legs. It's a beautiful dick, fat and meaty with a dark red head that flares out from the shaft. His foreskin is pierced with a thin steel ring. I just about shoot a load looking at it. Christ, I whisper. I never saw anything like it before. Crow looks proud. I had it done a couple of months ago. Under my eyes, his dick slowly stiffens and gets harder. Check it out, Crow urges. It won't bite. I get up on my knees, but Crow holds me back at arm's length for a second. Get naked first, he orders me. Only after I strip does Crow let me take his dick in my hand. I work the foreskin back and forth over the head, watching as the ring winks in and out of sight. Crow's fat dick is fully stiff now, and the feel of his warm, hard meat inside my hand gets my own cock all stiff and juiced up. I squeeze his dick, and a drop of pre-cum oozes out of the piss slit. I lick it up, whirling my tongue around the head, tasting the saltiness of the spermy pearl. I look up at Crow and grin. "My favorite flavor," I say. "Yeah," Crow grins. "Rum raisin." We both laugh. I work my lips down the length of Crow's shaft in small nibbles until my nose is buried deep in his pubes. I inhale deeply, breathing in the musky, pungent stink of Crow's cock and balls. Crow begins pumping his hips, and his dick slides easily in and out of my mouth. I feel the ring scrape inside my cheek, and I run my tongue over it. I wrap my hand around Crow's balls. They have a solid heft to them that feels like they were made for my palm. I squeeze them as I twist my head from side to side, giving his dick the full treatment with my tongue. Crow groans loudly. He seizes my head with both hands and thrusts his dick deep down my throat, mashing his pubes into my face. Then he pulls back and continues fucking my face in long, steady strokes. My other hand plays over his body, kneading the muscles of his torso, feeling his hard ass, tugging his tit rings. With his dick still in my mouth, I look up past the cut abs, the muscle-packed torso, the bull shoulders, to see his face staring down at me from what seems like miles. Crow grins. "You're a real pig for dick, aren't you?" he croons. "You just can't fucking get enough of it." And he's right. I'm a dick pig for sure. And I got my face buried in the trough tonight. I take his cock out of my mouth and start flicking his balls with my tongue. They hang loose and heavy above my face, furred lightly, the left nut lower than the right. I suck them both into my mouth and slobber my tongue over them, drool running down my chin. Crow starts beating my face with his dick, slapping my cheeks, my nose, and my eyes with it. My tongue blazes a wet trail down the hairy path to Crow's asshole. His ass cheeks are fleshy and muscular. I bury my face between them and then burrow in deep, probing his bunghole with my tongue. Crow goes apeshit, writhing around, grinding his ass into my face. I replace my tongue with my finger, working it slowly up his chute to the third knuckle, and then corkscrewing it around. Crow groans loud and deep. "How do you feel about fucking my ass?" he rasps. "I feel just fine about it," I tell him. He rummages under a pile of clothes and comes up with a jar of lube and a rubber. "Lie down on your back," he growls. He straddles my hips and wraps his greased hand around both our dicks, squeezing them together. I look down at the side of it, our two cocks being stroked together, slipping and sliding against each other inside Crow's big, calloused hand. Crow bends over and we kiss again. I take the lube from him, grease up my hand as well. Reaching behind, I pry apart Crow's ass crack and slide my grease-slimed finger inside his bunghole again. Crow squeezes his asshole tight, and I feel the muscles clamp down around my finger. I slowly pull it out, wiggling it all the way, and then shove it hard back in. Crow's body squirms against mine, and I push a second finger in. Crow groans loudly. "Lie down on your back," he gasps. I do so, holding my condom dick up straight as Crow lowers himself onto it. It slides into his ass smoothly, and Crow eases onto it like he's sinking into a hot bath. He closes his eyes and sighs loudly, and the look of pleasure on his face is so intense, I almost laugh. He begins riding my dick, pushing off my body and then sliding down again, and I pump my hips to meet him stroke for stroke. It's such a fucking hot sight, his pierced, tattoo muscle-packed body sliding up and down my cock. I wrap my still greasy hand around his dick and stroke it long and slow. With my other hand, I tug on his nipple rings, first the right one, then the left, then back to the right again. Crow's eyes glaze with pleasure, and something close to a whimper comes out of his open mouth. I pull his head down and kiss him hard, pushing my tongue deep down his throat as I pound his ass. Crow turns into a fucking maniac. He wraps his arms around me, and we roll around on the mattress, him snarling and howling like some goddamn animal. I feel like I'm in a segment from Wild Kingdom. I hear footsteps down the hallway outside, and then a laugh. "Go, Crow!" someone yells out. Crow's on his back now, and I shift to overdrive, roaring down his ass like he's just so many miles of bad road. Each pounding I give him seems to shove Crow deeper into the mattress. One hard thrust gets my dick in full to the balls. I grind my hips and slowly tear up his ass. Our eyes lock onto each other. Crow's are bright and sharp, not missing a thing. I see the challenge in them. He wraps his legs around me and clamps his ass muscles tight. My dick feels like it's gripped in soft velvet. And as I pull out and then thrust back in it, I feel like my whole fucking body is about to implode. Crow's lips are pulled back and his eyes laughing. The message in them is clear enough. Don't even think you're running this show. I pump my hips a few more times, and Crow matches me thrust for thrust, drawing me to the edge with a skill that blows my mind. The things I could learn from this guy. I groan loudly, and Crow reaches down and pushes hard against my nuts. Sweet Jesus, I just explode in that boy's ass, my dick squirting what feels like a couple of quarts worth of jizz into the condom. Before the last spasm is over, Crow flips me on my back and sits on my chest. As he fucks his hand, I reach up and pull down hard on his tit rings. He gives a whimper that trails into a long groan. His balls are pulled up tight now, and his dick is as stiff as dicks get. He's going to blow any second. He begins to spasm, and then the first load of jizz squirts out of his dick full in my face. Crow cries out as his wad rains down on me, sliming my face, dribbling down my chin, and into my open mouth. Crow collapses on top of me. Through the closed door, I can hear Pearl Jam on the tape deck down the hall. After a few seconds, Crow raises his head and starts licking his own Pearl Jam off my face. When he gets to my mouth, we kiss again, not like before, just nice and tender. I close my eyes and drift off to sleep, with Crow's naked body sprawled on top of mine. The next morning, Crow gives me back all the clothes he swiped. I catch him looking at Buck's butt-ugly bowling shirt. I hand it over to him. "Here," I say. "Do you want it?" Crow's happy to take it. He tells me that one of the guys is moving out in a couple of days, and if I'm looking for a place to crash, the room is mine. I say yes without even looking at it. The sun is just rising when I finally step out onto Haight Street. The winos and other homeless are just beginning to stir in the shop doorways. As I walk by, one of them sleepily asks if I have any spare change. I give him another one of Buck's shirts, and then just head on toward home, grinning.
That's Awful, That's Nothing, by Wade Krueger, from Best American Erotica 2001. Read by Myron Willis.
Up on deck for a smoke break, we'd taken up the topic of aggression between brothers. It was the four of us, Bernauer, Hampton, Foster, and I, a homely bunch of E1s off the coast of Crete, our first med cruise. The talk was charged with the heat of masculine competition. To have suffered the most under a brother was to have an edge on the others. Plus, we decided to make it interesting. Whoever won, we'd buy him drinks the whole time on the island. It had been decided, for no particular reason, that I should go first. "My brother had access to sausage," I said. "Not patties, but links. He worked in an Italian place. He'd bring home great long hoses of meat." "What I wouldn't give for some sausage," said Hampton. "Fry it up in a big black skillet," dreamed Foster. "Poke it with a fork." "My brother would wait till I was asleep," I went on. "Asleep or passed out drunk. He'd sneak into my room with a foot's length of sausage and prod with it at my face. He'd talk to me the whole time. 'Won't you nibble on it? Little love bite? Lick the tip. Just lick the tip, that's all I ask.'
I'd wake up with splotches of grease all over my cheeks and chin. I'd stink of paprika all day long. One drunk night, I took the sausage from him and clasped it to me fiercely. I held it like a teddy bear. He had to get pictures. He made duplicates. Put the shots in everyone's locker at school, even my girlfriend's. She could never look at me again. That's awful, Hampton said. That's nothing, said Foster. My brother hit 12 and went crazy for jerking off. He'd take hour-long showers and jerk it 3 or 4 times. He was a regular jizz factory. You could never get it all out of the tub. He'd clog up the drain with it. I'd find little rubbery filaments of his spunk all over my ankles.
I never went in for doing it in the shower, I said.
Oh, I did, Hampton said. Still do. Bet I've used more pert on my cock than my head. One time, Foster was saying, I had to get in there. I had to brush my teeth. I had a date. I picked the bathroom lock with a coat hanger. He knew I was in there. Didn't care. The whole time in the mirror, I could see his silhouette through the curtain. Oh, he was working it. Milking it. Talking to himself the whole damn time. Getting close now. Getting close. Getting close. He was keeping me up on his progress. By the time I'd rinsed and spit, he was saying, that was a nice one. That wasn't too bad. Out on my date, I couldn't think about anything else. That's awful, I said. I knew I was out of the running. That's nothing, said Hampton. My brother's cock is enormous. Got me by a good 2 inches at least. I'm talking length and girth. 2 years younger than me, walking around with the stuff of legend up under his wranglers. From the time I got to where I knew how important your cock is, I knew what it was like to feel inferior because of my own. I understood how impressive his cock was before he did, and all I could do was envy the thrill he'd feel on finding out for himself. Lord, when he found out. Got laid more than I did. He did it with girls I wanted to do it with, and did it with some girls I even had done it with. Hard to believe there was a time in my life, Foster said. I thought the thing was only for pissing. I get to where I think the pissing mechanism's only incidental, I said. That just doesn't seem like the main work it's intended for, you know? Situation similar to yours, Hampton said, indicating Foster with a nod. Only worse. He was in the bathroom. I needed in. Only he didn't have the door locked. I just walked on in. He was stark naked in front of the mirror with that monster in his hand. He wasn't even hard. He just had it in his hand. He was flapping it, seeing how far up and down it swung. I got in there, and he turned so he could show me. That's where it is, he told me. That's where it is. And all Hawkinsville knows it. It was like one of them snake handlers over in Alabama. I just turned and ran. That one gave us pause. Hampton stood back with a smug look of achievement. That'll be hard to beat, I said at last. That's awful, Foster agreed. That's nothing. Bernauer, whose idea this had all been in the first place, sucked his Winston to the filter and threw it overboard. He threw it like he was throwing a dart, like he had to aim at what he had hoped to hit. Then he shook another from his pack and fired up. Let me tell y'all what I dreamed the other night, he said. He gave us each a look. I dreamed I fucked my brother. He had a pussy and balls, too. I took him from behind, like dogs. Like I used to take my girlfriend, the one in Charleston. He made serious grunts and kept his eyes closed. He had a frown of pleasure on his face. He needed a shave and his skin wasn't so hot. Little breakouts here and there. When I came, I woke up. And God damn it all if I hadn't soiled the sheets and jizzed in my shorts. And I'm not even queer. I don't know if I'll ever talk to him again. I've barely been able to eat for 3 days.
None of us had looked him in the eye while he was talking. None of us was looking at him now. Then Hampton piped up. He knew it was over, but he wasn't going down without a fight.
And you ain't sticking by the rules. Your brother ain't done nothing to you. That's all in your mind. That's something you done to yourself. That's another contest. That ain't the game we was playing.
But we weren't the kind of guys to make much of technicalities. I made a move to go back below deck, and I was glad to have lost.
In This Corner, by Charles Flowers, from Best American Erotica 2001, read by Stephen Hoy.
The first time I saw him was in the inaugural issue of C, a glossy magazine aimed at Latino readers. Fashion, language, food, music, bilingual education, all the concerns of middle to upper middle class urbanites of Nueva York, Miami, Houston, Los Angeles. In the midst of all this culture was an 8-page spread of somebody called Oscar De La Hoya, a young boxer on the cusp of fame. Oscar looked at me with his deep brown eyes, and I felt my heart shudder. Trouble. His face was pretty, with small features, lashes curling up toward his thick eyebrows. He wasn't a Tyson, some massive body of violence. He had a lean torso and a scattering of hair across his pecs, which were small but firm, human. The first photo featured him in a deep purple satin robe, shadowboxing an imaginary opponent, the gym outside the ring dark and moody, broken by shafts of skylight. In the next shot, he wore a midnight blue satin shirt, open to his flat belly, his face wet from a spritzing. Another shot displayed him shirtless, leaning back a bit, his face lifted toward a fan circulating the sweaty musk of the gym, his hands thrust into linen trousers. I imagined him suited up, cruising Ocean Drive in Miami, wearing sunglasses, his face inscrutable, until a sudden burst of light. His smile, a crescent of white above his unshaven chin. Transfixed by his stare, I was disappointed to find no real text to accompany the photographs, just designer names and prices. I didn't even know then if he was really a boxer. Maybe he was just a model. Surely this perfect face had never been punched, bloodied. Boxers were brutes. Rocky, Tyson, Spinks, huge, ugly mugs of sneers and sweat, streaked with cuts and swollen with bruises. But this boy was different. Oscar. Not the most romantic of names. The Grouch. The Odd Couple. Oscar Meyer. Aha! At last a pun. Oscar's meat. A phallic lunch punch. But De La Hoya is another ball game, and my mind plays with the music of all those syllables. My Toya De La Boya, delicious De La Hoya, all day De La Hoya. Once I began to look, Oscar was everywhere. His face was plastered all over town on posters advertising an upcoming bout. I'd come up out of the subway at Times Square to find an HBO billboard with De La Hoya emblazoned 6 feet high in golden letters. His fight face, no smile, concentration defining his brow, was fierce, but still stunning. The same deep brown eyes, his slicked back hair the color of asphalt wet from rain, sleek and shiny. I wondered what his fuck face was like. Framed by the wings of my legs, would he grunt and grimace as sweat dripped from his nipples onto my chest? Or would his face remain a mystery as he bit his lower lip to keep from smiling? Cruising by a newsstand, I stopped when I saw him on the cover of Men's Fitness. As the reigning welterweight champion of the world, he was elected Boxer of the Year for 1997. The article gave all his career stats, 27-0, 22 knockouts, which bored me. But then I started to stiffen at a photo spread of Oscar's workout tips. After throwing money at the cashier, I raced home to draw a hot bath, my favorite place to masturbate. Soaking in near-scalding water, I fed myself images of Oscar working out in his gym, his chest straining to lift a military press, his hands a blur as he worked the speed bag. As I licked at the sweat streaming down my biceps, I could taste the salt of his body, each bead of water wrung from his golden brown skin. I threw the magazine off to the side, then lifted my legs to my chest, clenching my knees as I sank back and down to the bottom of the tub. As I held my face up to the surface of the water, my lower back loosened, opening my ass to Oscar's liquid heat. When I finally emerged from the bath, I found the magazine ruined. Oscar's body, like mine, wrinkled and puckered in the steam. I resolved to buy another one the next day for a keepsake. In the meanwhile, though, at the end of the article, I found a golden glove. www.oscardelahoya.com. I logged on, dripping at my desk, and Oscar's homepage flashed before me. A photo collage of Oscar, fighting, relaxing, smiling, sweating. I gorged myself with the details from the interviews. A native of East Los Angeles, he was the only American boxer to win a gold medal at the 1992 Summer Games in Barcelona. Born in 1973, he lost his mother to breast cancer when he was 18. His father was a professional boxer in Mexico who pushed his young son to fight as early as 5 years old. But a tenderness emerged that sounded all too familiar. When he first tried boxing, one of the profiles shared, he would cry and run home to hide in his room because he didn't want to fight. A handsome young man with no steady girlfriend who was focusing all his energy on his boxing. His recipe for golden blintzes appeared in a Tito Puente celebrity cookbook. He rebuilt a run-down boxing gym in his old neighborhood, giving inner-city boys a chance at self-esteem and a career like his. And again, a bachelor who dates often but has no steady girlfriend. Cooks, does volunteer work, no steady girlfriend. Sounds like the stories I told my family when I was in the closet. That night, I joined Team De La Hoya, his fan club. 4 weeks later, for $39.95, I received a black baseball cap, a poster of Oscar dressed out in an electric blue sweatsuit, a license plate frame, too bad I don't drive a lowrider, and a steamy autographed portrait of him in black and white, wearing a black satin robe, his hands gloved and held up, the hollow of his chest a dark thicket of hair. This lasted me for a while. Soon every Latino boy I passed on the street was a stand-in for Oscar, and I'd sniff as they passed to catch a whiff of cologne. My head would turn at every salsa tune drifting from a passing car. Riding the subway, I'd stiffen at the sight of a gold chain on a brown neck next to me, and I began to wish I were a crucifix to nestle in the black, wiry bramble of a Mexican boy's chest. But it wasn't enough. I'd become a boxing junkie and a Latin hawk. When the Blue Velvet Boxing Club opened a few blocks from my apartment, I knew what I had to do. I spent a couple of days walking by the plain wood storefront, trying to glimpse the shadowy figures within. I wanted to know what it felt like to box, to enter a ring with a man who wanted to hurt me. What would that do to my body? Besides, Oscar had inspired me. He'd given me an idea for a novel, an Anglo-Latino homo thing, like a gay West Side Story. Oscar and Charles, boxer and editor. I wanted our lips locked in Latin rhythms, our tongues to tango across our borders. How could I write a convincing boxing novel, I rationalized, without training at a boxing gym? I practically fell into the place. The door was old and creaky and jammed, so when I forced it open, I lost my balance and stumbled into a guy who looked like a manager.
"Whoa, buddy, what's up?"
he asked. I wanted to find out about some boxing lessons.
"You've come to the right place. I'm Gino," he said, as he offered his hand,
and then put a brotherly arm across my shoulders.
"Let me show you the place."
His arm was heavy on my neck, but sexless in a straight guy way, graceful and unconscious. His skin was smooth, pale olive, his dark hair oily. He smelled like fresh-baked bread, doughy and warm. He walked me around the ground floor where a boxing ring sat majestic beneath the room's single skylight. Downstairs was a weight area, a locker room with showers, nothing fancy. I nodded and tried to butch it up a bit, walking stiffly and deepening my voice, talking in monosyllables.
"Cool. Great.
Tough. The language of the enemy." I signed up for a 3-month membership and a set of 10 training sessions beginning the next day. I walked home exhilarated and terrified. I'd never thrown a punch in my entire life. That night, in another hot bath, I thought of Oscar and wondered if my boxing lessons might lead to a chance encounter. Maybe I'd enter an amateur boxing contest and he'd be the judge, and I'd impress him, despite my rough skills, with killer determination. My will to triumph would inspire him to take me under his wing, and he'd offer to let me work with him in his training camp. Working out with him, running trails in the woods near his camp, sparring with him alone in a dusky gym, we'd grow close. He'd mentor me with his body, and ever the willing, grateful pupil, I'd offer my heart in exchange. When I walked into Blue Velvet the next day, my chest fluttered, like the first time I dared to enter a gay bar. Gino threw me a towel and told me to pick out a locker downstairs. Undressing felt unreal. Whenever I'm naked in a new place, I get hard. When the air hits my skin, instead of getting goosebumps, I stiffen, as if at any second I'm going to get stroked. Undressed, my body became alive, expectant, even though the locker room was deserted. The newness of the place and the rhythms of the gym above made me feel even more naked and alien. Upstairs, sexy disco music and testosterone were pumping at equal levels. There were a couple of guys working out in the ring, their bodies aflame with speed and sweat, throwing punches in time to the George Michael tune blaring from the speakers. I kept wanting to dance, but I was afraid I would move my hips too much.
"Yo, Charlie,"
Gino yelled as I walked up the stairs from the locker room.
"Did you bring your wraps?"
Wraps? I had no idea what he was talking about.
"Never mind. Here, use these."
He handed me 2 rolls of cotton material.
"This is Ness, your trainer."
Ness was big. Bigger than Oscar, who's only 5'10 and a welterweight, 147 pounds. This guy looked like Tyson. A real heavyweight. His arms were massive hammers, and his navy T-shirt strained against his chest, the white Blue Velvet logo taut between his pecs.
"Hey, what's your name again?"
he asked as Gino walked away.
"Charles. How about I call you C?"
"Sure," I thought. "Whatever. And you? Your name?"
"Ness. As in Elliot."
He walked me to an empty area in front of a huge mirror that covered almost the entire wall. Off to my right was a Latino guy who looked about 15. He was boxing his reflection, moving and throwing punches to the beat, pulsing from the speakers in the corners of the gym.
"First, you gotta warm up,"
Ness instructed as he led me through a series of squats and jumping jacks. Then he handed me a jump rope.
"Do 2 rounds of rope, and then we'll put on some gloves."
My first thought was, this is the test for fags. Ness turned away,
and I looked above the mirror at the wall where the owner had painted, "All things are possible." I took a deep breath and threw the rope over my head. I tried a sort of run.